He wrote to Jane afterwards, a separate sheet to enclose with a letter he had already begun to her. He felt he could not put off so unpleasant a task on Granby as to convey the intelligence of the loss of the egg. If it had not been estimated so valuable in England, here it had been priceless, where the long journey would make any shipment of additional eggs all the more difficult. And if Jane had fresh hostilities to contend with in Spain, she would all the less wish to spare more eggs to the very hypothetical breeding grounds of this new continent. The camp was quiet except for coughing. Lawrence sipped at a mug of grog at intervals himself, the heat a little soothing against the rawness of his throat. There was a heaviness to his limbs, and despite all the game easy to hand, he did not wish to eat apart from a little biscuit soaked in water, which went down softly. No one had much appetite. Aviators often did not set a regular meal hour, and lately the scarcity of water had made their mealtimes still more irregular, occurring when sufficient number of the party began to make a noise of protest. Today no one spoke, even as the day advanced and the noon hour must have gone, even though the sun had not shown itself clear. The young aviators only had an interest in their surroundings, more resilient. Domain had been foraging, and Roland had organized Sifo and Paul Widener, Rankin's signal ensign, an anxious and fretful sort of boy, to butcher his findings and put out the meat to dry, sprinkled thoroughly with salt. For their immediate delectation they roasted a brace of large lizards on sticks. Domain had found them alive, but so dazed by smoke and thunder they might be taken by hand. "It is quite good, sir," Roland said, offering some to Lawrence. But what little of the smell he could perceive over the clouding of his senses was not appealing enough to provoke his deadened appetite. They had already more meat than they would require for the return voyage. Domain went out again anyway, unable to resist the bounty, and coming back in the space of less than half an hour put down his latest trophy, a handsome-sized kangaroo, only a little singed, and then ducked under Temeraire's wing. Lawrence looked up. Domain said, "There are men there, on the other side of those dunes." The men were for attacking at once. "Before they creep away again, and come lurking upon us during the night and steal away another," O'Day said, presenting this to Lawrence and Rankin as a petition on their behalf. "Even the little one ought to be able to do for them," meaning Caesar, rather bloodthirstily. And Rankin said icily, "That will be quite enough, Mr. O'Day. When your opinion is desired again, it will be solicited." A good deal of resentful muttering followed this, which the convicts did not trouble themselves to keep low. Rankin ignored it roundly, but Lawrence shook his head a little. He had seen mutiny before, and with less motivation than the conviction of imminent murder. With Temeraire and even Caesar a little ill and groggy, there could be a real mischief done, if the convicts chose to try and seize upon himself or Rankin or even another of the crewmen whom Temeraire valued. "It is not them," Domain said loudly and impatiently. "They do not have the egg." Temeraire stirred here from his restless drowse and raised his head. When he understood, he brightened and said, "But perhaps they may know where the others have gone," and swinging his head towards the convicts, asked, "Can no one of you speak with them?"
"It is no good talking to them," O'Day said. "What we want is some quick action. If they know we are here, they're sure to run off again and steal back."
"They do know we are here," Domain said. "They saw me taking the kangaroo."
"Well, he's a black fellow, though, isn't he? One of them," one man said.
Domain was certainly of sable complexion, but hailing from the south of Africa had no more in common with the natives than this accident of coloration, although Lawrence supposed doubtfully this might engender some common feeling, or at least defer the suspicion which their own appearance, so far different, might provoke.
"Are any of you gentlemen conversant with their tongue?" Lawrence said, and after a little shuffling, O'Day granted that he had some experience.
So too did a Richard Shipley, one of the younger of the convicts, not 21, who said,
"Though not much more than to trade some rum or some buttons for, well, sir, for a little company," with a blush.
"I cannot see how that will be any use here," Temeraire said anxiously. "I might make out a little bit, or they might know some other language. Perhaps I ought to come as well."
"That must substantially diminish any hope of their receiving us in a friendly manner," Lawrence said, and checked his pistols instead, which, if smaller, were no less deadly.
He and Tharkey and Forthing took their two prospective interpreters, however inadequate, and Domain led them over the charred dunes perhaps a mile from the camp, near the far edge of the seared band, where the marks of the fire ended and the vegetation had escaped. The Aborigines had already collected their own supply of game. many dead animals strung together, and were standing near the unburnt ground, holding some discussion amongst themselves. Four men and a youth, perhaps a few years older than Demaine. Lawrence was surprised when they drew nearer to see that the ground before them was burning, and evidently by their doing. They were watching it with narrow, careful attention, and stamping out flames which leapt back towards them. The Aborigines received them not unwarily, but without open hostility, and when Shipley and O'Day hesitantly spoke, they listened and made some reply. This at once exceeded the translator's limits. Shipley said, "It don't sound at all like. A word or two, maybe." Lawrence turned instead to pantomime and sketch work. In the conveniently empty canvas of the burnt ground, which showed his lopsided figures red against the black of the ash, he tried to draw a picture of the egg, large, being carried away by small men, blank looks only, and then held out a fragment of the pottery. This opened some species of communication. The Aborigines nodded, and one held out a spear-thrower, which Lawrence was startled to see decorated at the end with a string of porcelain beads in red and blue, and another of jade and pearls. He pointed at the pistol in Lawrence's belt. Lawrence shook his head and said, "No, I thank you," rather bewildered to be offered such a bargain in the middle of the desert. The hunter shrugged and equally accepted refusal, and when Lawrence brought out his map and laid it out, they were willing enough to look down at the chart. This, however, they did not seem to think meaningful. They touched the paper between their fingers appreciatively, and traced the coloured lines of ink, but turned it upside down and back without sign of recognition. Even the territory lately traversed, which Lawrence pointed out to them, the newly marked creek beds and salt pans and hills, which must have been familiar landmarks, but perhaps the Aborigines did not have the habit of map-making. Instead, Shipley pointed at the necklace and asked, "Where?" in the version of the language which he knew, then pointing in each direction of the compass. The Aborigines answered with, "Bijanjatjara," and "Larikia," and pointed north and west, with almost a throwing gesture, and another word. "Far, far," Shipley said. "I think that's what it means, anyway." "And then what about the men they have been snatching?" O'Day said, and drew in the sand several figures in stick form, and by them the waterhole and the rock outcropping where Jonas Green had vanished. He then crossed out one of his figures. The Aborigines nodded without surprise and said, "Bunyip," and shook their heads vigorously. "Bunyip," they repeated, and crossed the man out more thoroughly and said a great deal more, which might have been excellent advice if they could have understood a word of it. But then, perceiving they were not understood, the youngest of their company proceeded to hold up his hands like claws by his mouth, and made a hissing, snatching gesture, with a growl, rather looking like a children's bogey. And Lawrence grew doubtful of the proffered explanation. There had certainly been no monsters wandering about the camp. But O'Day proved more willing to accept this excuse, and somewhat mollified, trying more of his limited supply, found a few more common words. He drew the egg larger, and showed a dragon coming out of it, wings outspread. The Aborigines repeated their gesture towards the northwest, and then the oldest tapped the youth on the shoulder, demanding attention, and opening his mouth sang in a low and gravelly, if resonant, voice, the other man clapping softly along to add rhythm to the chant. "No use to trying to work that out," O'Day said, looking around. "They go off so from time to time when you ask them directions, but it is only these stories of theirs, monsters and gods and the making of the world. It doesn't mean anything." The song finishing, and the small, smudgy fire also, the men bent to take up their strings of game and to move on to another patch of the grasslands. The youth stepped into the newly burnt section and took himself a branch still burning quietly at one end. Lawrence would have liked to try and get a little more intelligence out of them, perhaps recruiting Dorset, who was a good hand at draftsmanship, and trying to, with better illustrations, convey more precise questions. But the hunters had evidently tired of a conversation of so little profit to themselves, and to restrain them could only provoke the quarrel which the men had formerly imagined. "Bunyips," O'Day repeated to Shipley with a ghoulish satisfaction as he walked back towards the camp. "So it is bunyips, and they must be man-eaters. Did you see how those black fellows shook at the word? God rest their souls, Jack Tully and poor Jonas. In a bunyip's belly it is a cruel way to end. Like tigers they must be." The story would certainly be all across the camp in moments when they had returned, and the men undoubtedly as pleased to transfer all their fears to man-eating monsters as to native tribesmen, or more pleased for the greater hideousness of the threat. Lawrence sighed and climbed wearily up the dune ahead to wave a reassuring hand to Temeraire, who should be worrying. But when he came in sight, Temeraire was looking down instead at the egg, which Fellows was hastily taking out of its wrappings.